This is Vectis Radio. For the people, by the people.
Hello and welcome to this week's edition of Wit, Wisdom and Pratfalls with me, Joan Ellis. That's just me today. My guest was unwell, so we'll be meeting her at a later date. But today, it's just me with my books, and we're going to be talking about reading, and we're going to be talking about everything, really, because I think that's what writing is. It's all about, for me, it's about real life and fiction that is inspired by events and people that you've met. So it's all that fantastic earwigging that you do on buses and, you know, in restaurants when you're half hear a conversation, and that just gives you the impetus for a new story or even a newspaper article, anything at all. So that's what we're going to kick off with today. And but just to set the tone, when I was in reception here at Riverside, I saw something and I thought, I've just got to share it with everybody. It's a piece of advertising from Southern Water, a sort of information sheet, really. And they say, only flush the three P's, pee, poo and paper. So these have got to go down the toilet, and anything else has to go in the bin. So sensible advice. So that's Southern Water's idea of the three P's, is pee, poo and paper. Very different, not to be confused with Vectis's four P's. And this is, they stand for promotion, producing, presenting and podcasting. And this is open to a very important course, open to 11 to 19 year olds, or up to 25 with additional needs. And it's a wonderful opportunity for young people to get involved with radio. And even if that's not something you want to do when you know, as a career, it's something that would give you so much confidence and could really help with communication skills, anything. They just look great on your CV as well. So, and a really fun way to spend time. So if you're interested in that, please get in touch, and you can follow us on Twitter at Vectis Radio and Facebook. So we'd love to hear from you. Okay. So back to the murderer. Yeah, I met a murderer on a train. Now, he told me he was a murderer, and people have said perhaps he was just a bit of a fantasist, a liar. Maybe he was, but the way he acted, he made my flesh crawl. And the things he told me about his life on the edge, being in prison, some of the crimes he'd committed, the people he'd met, what he'd got up to, I thought, this can only be real. And he described in great detail what he was capable of. So having been stuck next to him on a train, I wasn't going to challenge whether he was telling me the truth or not. I knew enough to think there's a very good possibility that this man has done exactly what he said he's done. And I, like I said, so I was sitting at one of those seats with the table in between on Southwest trains. I was coming back from Waterloo to Portsmouth. And he seemed very charming. He seemed nice. He helped me put my case on the rack. He you know, smiled. He made sort of pleasant conversation. And then it all started to change. You know, little bits of information were coming out, and I felt less and less comfortable. And again, people have said to me, well, why didn't you just get up and move? You know, that's what any normal person would do. Probably is what any normal person would do, but sadly, that's not me. I sat there, and it was because I was really frightened of him that I stayed, which, if people have never encountered violence in their lives, then I think you might find that very hard to understand. But I just, to my way of thinking, if I kept him calm and if I was polite, you know, if I didn't do anything to antagonise him, that was the best way forward. I thought, if I make a break for it and try and sort of lock myself in the loo, or get off at the next station, he could follow me. And none of us are very good, I don't think, at stepping in on public transport if there's a bit of a fracas. I mean, I'd like to think I would, but sometimes these situations can get out of hand very quickly. So I didn't want to put other people in that situation, so I thought, just sit here and be quiet and I'm sure it'll all be fine. But as I say, he then started taking liberties. He asked to read my paper, which was fine. I gave him the paper. Then he let on that he couldn't read. So clearly that was just some sort of ruse. He reached out and he touched my arm. And then immediately said, oh, I shouldn't have done that, should I? And then did it again later on in the journey. So he was clearly trying to push my buttons. And he was just, like I say, really unpleasant. And so unpleasant that I actually texted a friend of mine. And he's got a, you know, I just thought he'll help. He's got quite a lot of money and he might just help and send a helicopter. I was having all these mad fantasies, you know, to meet me at Portsmouth. But sadly, when I texted saying, on the train with a murderer, he just texted straight back and said, murderer, ? What you like? ! No, that wasn't the response I wanted. Anyway, having survived this ordeal, when I was walking down the pier at Ryde, having got home, I thought, yeah, that was a real close shave. But it was golden in a way, because he gave me so much information that I'd never seen in a film, never read in a book. Incredible. Hadn't even read in a newspaper or any of those kind of true life crimes. I thought, this is wonderful information that when I've had a stiff brandy and recovered, I could probably put to good use. So I was writing Chick Lit, my first book. I'm Ella Bimy is all about my life in advertising. So when I in the 80s and the 90s, so it's a sort of Mad Men meets Bridget Jones, if you like. So it's quite flippant, very light-hearted, and I thought, I won't be able to write a thriller. It's not me, all those twists and turns and not being able to guess the ending. But having met this guy, there was the inspiration. So I'm going to read you now from The Killing of Mummy's Boy. And not only did he give me the inspiration for the novel, that led on to other things, as often in life, isn't it? If you just say yes and do something, it's amazing that domino effect it has. And I wrote the book, and Ian, because it's partly set here and partly set in London, and Ian, very kindly, Ian Mack, who runs Vectis, invited me to be interviewed about it. So I came in, and then he suggested I came and was a co-presenter with him and Dame Shirley, which I thoroughly enjoyed, and then was brave enough and kind enough to offer me my own slot. So wonderful things have come from that. So that's why I dedicated this book, The Killing of Mummy's Boy, to the anonymous killer on the train, because in a way he gave me a very dark gift, but I'm very grateful for that gift, because it was the insight into a criminal mind that I would never have had otherwise. Okay, so here we go. Chapter 1, Waterloo to Portsmouth, 2013. It was Sandra's first journey back to London since she had moved to the Isle of Wight a few years before. Having a stretch of water between her and the mainland made her feel safe. The Solent could be expensive to cross. Some people thought twice before making the journey. She liked that. Once on board, she'd found an empty table and taken off her coat before absent-mindedly plucking a stray hair from her cardigan. A man was watching from the aisle. She followed his gaze. To her embarrassment, her fingers were resting against her left breast. Flummoxed, she struggled with her case, making several unsuccessful attempts to lift it onto the luggage rack. Here, let me. Now it was her turn to watch as he swung the case up over his head and positioned it on the shelf. His white T-shirt rode up, revealing the lower half of his torso. Her eyes tracked the thin line of black hair that ran from his navel and disappeared under the waistband of his jeans. He flopped down into the seat opposite. She glanced at her phone. No messages. She sighed and slid it into the pocket of her handbag where she kept her Oyster card. But the travel card wasn't there. She must have dropped it when she was topping it up at the station. Luckily, the card was registered, so she wouldn't lose any money. Quickly, she took out her mobile again, scrolled down, and clicked. Hello. Hi, I'd like to report a lost oyster. Sorry. Can you hear me? Can you hear me now? Yeah, my name. My name is Sandra. Sandra Williams. Dove Cottage, Isle of Wight, PO305AB. 5AP? P for Papa? No. It's B. B for... The man smiled at her, and her mind went blank. Bravo, he whispered over the top of his paper. She gave him the thumbs up by way of thanks. Yeah, it's B. B for Bravo. Yep, card's registered. Hello? Hello? Can you hear me? Can you still hear... Oh. The line went dead. Irritated to have lost the signal, she sighed and locked her phone. The man threw down his paper, making her jump, and reached into the pocket of his jeans. Fanning out three oyster cards on the table, he pushed one towards her. His nails were bitten, his cuticles ragged and bloody. No, thank you, it's yours. Go on, have it. No, I don't need it. I'll get a replacement. Why have you got so many? He shrugged, gathered up the cards, and put them in his pocket. I always lose something when I go to London. Oh, where in London? She asked, leaning forward, seizing the opportunity to talk about her hometown. Leighton. Me girls live there. I haven't seen them for years. He said it dismissively, as if years was just another word for hours. She raised her eyebrows at him. How come you haven't seen your children for so long? Been inside, he replied, lifting his eyes from her cleavage and looking her in the eye, keen to gauge her reaction. What for? She asked, faking nonchalance. Isn't that the third time? Well, what did you do? I slit someone's throat. So, yes, that was more or less what happened, really. And those were his words to me. So, once he'd said that, I wasn't really going to risk messing with him. And he had a bag which looked pretty full, and I thought that could contain anything. So my imagination was going over time, but he had already planted the seeds of fear and mistrust. And sure, it could have been somebody just having some fun and playing a really nasty mind game. Somebody quite disturbed, I would imagine, but somebody that twisted, I wouldn't want to mess with them anyway, whether they were capable of murder or not. I thought it best to kind of keep... Like I say, keep him sweet. Unfortunately, because I was so non-confrontational, he misread those signals, and at the end of our journey, he asked me to run away with him. Obviously, I passed on that wonderful offer, but he was very arrogant. He really thought he was quite something, and very confident. And just had this nerve to ask a complete stranger out like that on the train. And I don't know. I mean, like I say, he really did affect me because I've made him the centre of this book. But the book isn't, you know, the two people you meet are not who you think they are by the end. You know, there's a very different backstory that they both have. So he's not necessarily who you might perceive him to be in the first chapter. And neither is she, hence the title. So it's got lots and lots of twists and turns. And the best bit is that people come up to me in Newport and they say, I've sat up all night reading your book and I couldn't guess the ending. And I'm like, yay, that's brilliant. So that's kind of your job's done, because if you're writing a thriller and people can guess from sort of page two, who's done it, then perhaps need to rewrite the ending. But yeah, great fun. And another thing that I did here, and I don't know if anybody's interesting that's written a book, who's interested in turning it into an audio book, they do a service here, which Ian very kindly kind of nursed me through, to record the book myself. Obviously, you could get your own voiceover in to do it, or you could do it here. It's quite a long process, obviously, because, as you know, if you've written a book, they're about sort of 70,000 to 100,000 words. So quite a few hours, long, lonely hours recording it and then editing it. But at the end, you have an audio book. You know, you have it, you can have it as that version, which is really good. And a lot of people say to me, I don't read normal books, either on a tablet or a paperback, but they will listen to an audio. So that's something to think of. And again, please get in touch with Ian Mack here at Vectors Radio if that's something you might be interested in, because I thoroughly enjoyed doing it. I was here on my own quite a lot of nights, so it was terrifying, but that added to the atmosphere, really. So it was, I really enjoyed doing that. I'll just read you a little bit more from this one. And this is a chapter 7 now. And she's realised she's had the Oyster card has been delivered to her cottage. So she's realised that he was listening quite intently when she was giving out those details over the phone. Either he was or somebody else, but she's put two and two together and come up with that solution, and she's blamed him. He knew where she lived. The man on the train knew where she lived. The murderer knew where she lived. It made coming home a terrifying experience. Each time she was forced to walk in his footsteps. Each time she was fearful, not knowing what or who she might find. The terror had not lessened over time. It got worse. As soon as she stepped off the bus and the doors closed behind her, she was alone, but for the fear that became a constant and unwelcome companion. This time, she quickly stole past trees and bushes, avoiding the whispering shadows that could be disguising potential danger. When she reached the cottage, her heart hammering, she wondered if the man had looked through the window to get a glimpse of how she lived. She hated the idea of him intruding in that way. Her hand shaking, she managed to unlock the door on her third attempt. She went in and closed it quickly behind her. The room, with its functional, unfashionable furniture, was not to her taste. The only precious object was the photograph of Totland Bay that hung in pride of place above the fireplace. She had taken it on her son's, Carl's, birthday 2 years ago. Since he had been on the witness protection program, she had been unable to celebrate with him in person and had to find other ways of marking the occasion. That year, the weather had been particularly good, and she'd decided on a drink at the waterside. She had sat outside the pub, surrounded by people, but alone with her thoughts, watching the sun go down. As it set over the sea, she had captured the moment. Locking the door and flicking on the radio, she relaxed as the DJ's silky, smooth voice seemed to single her out from his millions of listeners and speak to her alone. It was an old trick, but she didn't care. The mindless chatter was soothing and suited her just fine. "Do you ever get that?" asked the DJ. "You're walking along and someone says, 'Hiya, mate, how's it going?' And you're thinking, 'Do I know you or are you just some weirdo?' Hey, if that's happened to you, text the word 'stranger' to..." She quickly turned it off, her mind jolting back to the man on the train. What if he came back? What if he was here, hiding inside the cottage? She froze, her heart pounding against her ribs. "Dove Cottage, Shorewell, PO305AB, she could hear herself saying on the train. "B for Bravo, B for Bravo. More like S for stupid," she thought bitterly. Cautiously, she crept upstairs and flung open her bedroom door, causing the handle to bang against the wall. From the doorway, she could see the whole of the room, even under the bed. Nothing. Her wardrobe was on the landing. She pulled the door and swung it open. Her scant collection of clothes hung like husks on the rail. As she approached the bathroom, a wild face greeted her. She leapt back, terrified, before realizing she was looking at her own reflection. Breathing heavily, she headed back downstairs and into the kitchen. She sat at the table and told herself to calm down. There was nothing to worry about. The man had played his sick little joke, game over. Gradually, her heartbeat slowed. She decided a cup of tea would soothe her nerves and reached into the fridge for the milk. Spotting half a loaf of bread, she put two slices into the toaster before opening the cupboard where she kept her special plate. Carl had spotted it in a junk shop in Brighton on one of their many excursions and had asked to have his pocket money early so he could buy it. It was one of the few gifts he'd given her over the years and she treasured it. It was not in its usual place, but it was always in the cupboard above the sink. She glanced across at the shelves and work surfaces, no sign. Frantically, she tried to recall when she'd last used it. It had been just before she'd left for London. Her cheese sandwich had tasted all the better for being eaten off such precious crockery. She remembered using the last of the washing-up liquid to clean it. She checked the bin. Sure enough, there was the empty bottle. As she turned back, she saw it in the sink. She went over, picked it up. It was covered in crumbs and smeared with a dark, sticky substance. She sniffed it. Marmite. She'd bought a new jar recently, but not used it. She opened the cupboard, found the pot and unscrewed the lid. Sure enough, the seal had been broken. She clung to the edge of the sink. He had been back to her house, and this time he had been inside. He must have wanted her to know. Just like before, he made no attempt to cover his tracks. How the hell had he got in? She was always so careful to lock up. She felt the vomit rise in her throat, bolted upstairs and into the bathroom, where she flung herself over the toilet. Looking down into the porcelain bowl, she was repulsed and shocked to see it was full of dark, foamy urine. She knew it couldn't possibly be hers. She'd not used the lavatory that morning. She had gone in the shower. Thank you. And on that note, no jokes about the three P's. Thank you very much. We're going to stop for a break, but I'm going to be back after with some light-hearted stuff and some more sort of tips on writing for anybody out there who wants to write, loves writing, loves reading. Okay, speak to you very soon.
Stay social and get in touch. It's /Vectis Radio on Facebook. The World Wide Web never felt so local.
Hello and welcome back to Wit, Wisdom and Pratfalls with me, Joan Ellis. You have no idea how terrifying it is for me sitting here because I'm bound to do a technical boo-boo. I sit here at this desk and it terrifies the living daylights out of me. But here we are, second half, and no one's died, we're fine. So we were talking before the break about The Killing of Mummy's Boy, which is a thriller I've written set here on the island. People have been kind enough to give it 5-star reviews. Not my mum, no one I know, but which is lovely, really great. And it was shortlisted last year in December for the Winston Fletcher Fiction Prize, which was judged by Tim Waterstone, who said it was outstanding. So I thought, well, I'll take that. That's lovely. Thank you very, very much for that, Mr. Waterstone. Yeah, and a lot of fun to write. And I think if you're thinking of writing, a lot of people say to me, oh, I've got a book, you know, I'd love to write. I've got a book in me that I want to write. How do I start? Well, that's how you start. You just start writing and you build it. You know, you get your words down. I mean, I was doing 1,000 words a day. And that might not suit everybody. I think that's a pretty good rule of thumb. I think quite a lot of writers work to that because you've got a 70,000, 100,000, if you're writing a novel, that's what you're aiming to do. And that seems like a massive amount, but if you break it down, you can do it. But of course, remember that the 1,000 words you write on a Monday, when you come back on a Tuesday and reread them, they're not necessarily going to be the right words in the right order. So you need to, it's the rewriting and the editing that I think is absolutely key, and that overnight test. And you're your best critic when you read your work and read it out loud, because people say, oh yes, I read it out loud, but they think they read it out loud, but what actually we're doing is reading it silently to ourselves in our head. But that gives you a liberty to skip over all the mistakes, and you don't hear the repetition, you don't hear the long sentences where you can't get to the end without heaving for a breath. So that's a really simple way to do a first double check on your work, and to double check you've got it as you want it. And that takes time. So I think writing is something, for me certainly, that can't be rushed. And in theory, obviously, if it's 1,000 words a day, like I say, you could do that in sort of 2.5-3 months. But it takes me a year, because it's that far more painful process, but ultimately rewarding process of rewriting and editing, that makes the book as good as it possibly can be. And that's where the patience comes in, because writing, I find it quite, when I write a book, very lonely. Particularly thrillers, I find myself in a very dark place, because for me, I'm getting in their minds, working out how a murderer might think, how they might feel, what motivates them to do certain things. So it's going into a very dark place of one's own psyche, really, and drawing on what we've seen in movies, what you've read in newspapers, like I say, what you picked up from sort of stories in the pub, all this that parts of our own life story, this great mosaic that we are, really. And just extrapolating those and breathing life into those just small filaments. It could be just an expression on somebody's face that you see that leads you onto this fictional journey and creates something quite special for you, you know. And I think, as I said, it has to be an enjoyable process to stick at that for a year and be committed. Do it every day. Get those words out, sit there at the laptop until you've completed what you need to do, and be prepared to examine those difficult sides, I suppose, to human nature, which can be very uncomfortable and very challenging, because they're not places we like to think that we can ever imagine. So to find yourself on a riff where you are thinking, talking, writing like a killer, that's as surprising as it is shocking. But I guess it's like being an actor. You have to inhabit that person's shoes, walk a mile in them, and walk their walk in order to talk their talk. And it's just about, like I say, keeping that listening ear all the time, not really switching off. Someone said to me, having read a couple of my books, oh, you give a lot of yourself away in your writing. But I think that's true. I think one does draw on oneself a lot. And for me, that's what gives a book its authenticity, so that when someone else reads it, it becomes completely credible, completely believable. If it didn't have that, I think it would be really superficial and wouldn't kid anyone. But in a sense, you are the author. You are just the conduit which these characters are going through, in a sense. So I don't think we should get too hung up on that idea, because that would make people like Agatha Christie a serial killer and Bram Stoker a vampire, which of course is nonsense. It's actually the same person that said to me that he wouldn't allow his wife to read The Killing of Mummy's Boy on the grounds that it was too terrifying. He'd read it and he said she had to be kept away from it because it was too terrifying. And I thought, actually, what's more terrifying, a work of fiction, or your ability to control what your wife can and can't read? So I know which I'd rather have. So It's strange, isn't it, where books take people, the discussions that they engender, the richness from which they come. And I was listening to a piece on the radio, and they were saying, it was a really cleverly entitled piece, saying, which book would you never lend? So which book is so wonderful you wouldn't entrust it to anyone for fear of not getting it back? Well, for me, it would be, what book would I lend? What would I give in order that that person, you know, I've read it, I've got it in my head, and I can give that book away in order to allow someone else, a good friend perhaps, to have a similar positive experience and get what I got, or maybe some completely different feel from the book, but something that was equally enjoyable. So I know I would have loved to have, if I'd had a teenage son, I would have loved to have given him Salinger's Catcher in the Rye, because I think that's a wonderful coming of age novel. And I think people who share their love of books, I've got a great friend who's also an author, Rowan Kandapa, and when we were working together in advertising in Soho back in the 80s, sometimes it could be a bit soul destroying, you know, working on cat food and cars and natural gas and all manner of strange products. But he would always, he'd buy me books, and he would keep his own copy, and then he'd buy me another copy of the same book and say, you know, read this, it's, you'll enjoy it. I know this one's, you'll love it. And he was invariably right. And he introduced me to Late Woebegone Days, which is, it's just, I love it. It's a gentle, very funny, very small stories, but with the heart of people and characterisation. Just beautiful, beautiful tales. And not everything has to be fiction. I've read the complete works of Dorothy Parker with her stunning, stinging one-liners and put-downs, the sort of thing you wish you had on the end of your own tongue, but invariably never do when you need to bring an insult to bear. And I think it's part of the package, isn't it? I think there's lots of people who adore reading, and they will read over watching TV or going to the cinema or perhaps other hobbies and pastimes, and that's great. But for me, it's something that I do as part of a whole. And writing now, I'm writing performance pieces, I'm writing plays and monologues I'm really enjoying for my show when I go up to Edinburgh. And that's, so a performance piece for me is written in a very different way, I think, to how I write the books, and a totally different feel, particularly, I suppose, because I know I've got to stand up. I've got to stand up and do it, really. I've got to bring it out the bag. So I think if you're interested in writing, my advice to you would be to pick up your pen or pick up your laptop and get writing. It doesn't matter what you write, just start. Stop talking about it, stop listening to other people talk about it, stop reading books about it even, and just get going. Get started, because being confronted with a blank sheet of paper, any artist writer will tell you, is the worst thing. Start filling it. Once you've got something that you've filled it with, you can start playing with it. Then you can start having some real fun. Even if you screw it up and it lands up in the bin, that's fine. That's part of the process. So don't be frightened of making mistakes, because out of those mistakes can come your best work. And it's a journey. So nothing is wasted. Nothing that you do really does end up in the bin, because that lesson has been learnt. So please, yeah, do it. Do it this weekend. Just go. If you even think, well, I can write, but I don't know what to write about, just get a copy of a newspaper, any newspaper. Take the headline story. Take it from an aspect of one of the characters. Maybe a character that's not even in the story. The mother of someone, the father of someone that's not mentioned. And just write it from their perspective. All those things. And it's great fun. And it's strange what comes out of that. Another trick I know a lot of writers, they just get a book and they open it and let it fall open at a page. And they'll use the first couple of words as a start for the chapter of a first book. again, that's wonderful. It's whatever works for you. But certainly, unless you start writing, you're never going to finish that book that's buried deep inside you, that you know is there and you want to breathe life into it. So going back to personal inspiration, my daughter Sophie, she's 20 now, but I was a lone parent, as was my mum. Neither of us set out to be. Mum got divorced when I was 8, and I split up from Sophie's father when she was 7 months old. And Mum brought me up on a council estate, no money. For some reason, I went to a convent school. I just don't know how that happened. Terrible error, really, I suppose, of judgment somewhere along the line. Nuns delighted when I passed my 11 plus and left. They really did sing hallelujah that day. Then went to a grammar school, loved it. People just like me, though. Really, it was great fun because, like I say, we had no money and free school meals, free school uniform. Very different way of being to how Sophie was brought up in the 90s, because I had to work full-time, but that gave us a certain quality of life, I suppose, that I hadn't had. Although I never went without, that was for certain. You know, my mum, bless her heart, she saved up every penny that she earned. She was an auxiliary nurse for years, and she saved up every penny and used to buy me these exquisite gifts that she could ill afford, but I think that was her way of trying to make things up to me. Not that she had to at all, because she's a fantastic mum. And we all know, or working mums or any mums know, it's one of the hardest but most rewarding jobs in the world. And we have our kids, and you know, we all think, well, I thought I was a yummy mummy for years. I wasn't at all. I was 36 when I had Sophie. I mean, I was really kidding myself here, but hey ho. I think that's how we are, isn't it? We some of us find it very hard to grow up and not accept that I've grown up. But in the end, it's all about family, isn't it? And it's all about loving one another, whether it be your friends or your family. So this is about a rather embarrassing situation I put myself through when I was old enough to know better. Yes, I was probably early 40s, and I was in London, and Sophie was only a little tot, probably about four or five years old, and it's called Kiss It Better. I had to kiss a lot of frogs before I found my prince. I even gave an ageing pop star a peck on the cheek in the hope we might live happily ever after. He had been my idol since I was 14 years old. I'd never seen anyone so handsome. I bought all his LPs. Each one had a life-size photo of his gorgeous face on the front, which I could kiss to my heart's content. I even saved up enough money from my paper round to see him in concert. Waving frantically from the third row, I assumed he would be unable to resist my frizzy perm and want to marry me one day. That night, he took his final bow. He jumped into his chauffeur-driven limo with a leggy blonde, and I caught the district line home to Mum. 30 years later, I heard he was touring. My heart leapt, my stomach lurched. Only needed the spots and I was a teenager again. The night of the concert, I rushed home from work to get ready. "Why are you wearing lipstick?" Sophie asked suspiciously as she scrutinised my reflection in the mirror. "I'm going out. Nan's coming to look after you," I said, kissing her goodbye. When I arrived at the theatre, I found myself surrounded by hordes of his fans who, like me, had loved him all their lives. As the lights dimmed, I couldn't wait to see him again. Suddenly, through the dry ice, he appeared. According to my rose-tinted bifocals, his sparkly eyes and devastating smile made 400 women forget about their husbands, boyfriends, and bunions. The man of my dreams he may have been, but I suspected he performed twice nightly in all the other women's dreams too. "Hello, London," he yelled. I had hoped for a more personal greeting, but he obviously hadn't spotted me yet. No matter, the night was young. even if I wasn't. He sang his old hits, and I danced like a loon. After the show, I snuck round to the stage with 30 or so other delusional menopausal women, all believing we were the one. Of course, we'd all been better off at home with a nice cup of tea and a biscuit. But instead, there we were, standing around getting cold, waiting for crumbs. The bouncers had seen it all before and growled at us to leave, but we weren't budging. 20 minutes later, the door opened. There, to my disappointment, stood the caretaker, an elderly man wrapped up against the cold in an overcoat and scarf. To my surprise, the women surged forward and demanded his autograph. Then, as everyone began to chant my idol's name, I realised this was no stagehand clinging on for his pension. This was my heartthrob, minus the makeup and flattering lighting. I imagined his grey hair back to black, and his crow's feet as evidence of his once winning smile. Then I heard someone shout out, "I think you're beautiful." "Silly woman," I thought. Then I realised it was me. As he swiftly signed my ticket, I could see he was mentally calculating how many more he would have to dispense before he could head back to his country pile. Without a word, or so much as a glance, he handed me his autograph. I leaned forwards to give him a thank you kiss on the cheek. "Don't do that," he said, his face devoid of the once trademark grin.
"No jumping up here,"
said his minder, as if I was some sort of rampant terrier in need of spaying. I recoiled and ran. "Nothing personal, darling," the pop star shouted after me. Oh, I had behaved like a fool, and an old one at that. "Whatever were you thinking?" Mum asked in disbelief when I told her what I'd done. "That poor man. I told you not to wear those jeans. No wonder he gave you the brush off." I went into Sophie's room. Her eyes were closed, her beautiful face framed against the pillow. I bent down and hugged her. Through sleep, she whispered, "I love you, Mummy." A kiss from a stranger. Why, when I've got true love, right here. That's from The Things You Missed While You Were Away, and it's just a collection of anecdotes, really. Some more funny, less poignant than others, I suppose. And it's about my childhood in the sort of 60s. Very different, like I say, council house, not a lot of money, washing around with my daughter Sophie's in the 90s, which was far more affluent, in sort of leafy Crouch End in London, but kind of rich or poor. I guess there's those golden moments that you treasure that have got nothing to do with the background you come from or the sort of family you're born into. They're just those wonderful gems that you treasure and you carry with you in your heart forever. So as a child, they form your memories, they form parts of who you are, and as a parent, you just cling on to those golden moments that, you know, we try so hard, don't we, to capture them on our phones, to capture them on film. And yes, it's wonderful to have those memories, but it's the actual, that second, isn't it, when we're actually there and it's happening, and it's something that you feel in that time. It's just golden. We had a lovely one recently, as regular listeners will know. My mother's in Polas, the care home. It's a wonderful care home on the island up at Staplers here in Newport, and she's got Alzheimer's, quite severe, and It's a very cruel disease. It's robbed her of the power of speech. So she says very few words, certainly can't form a sentence. But when Sophie's little baby, Archie, who's now nearly 7 months old, when we take Archie in to see Mum, his great-grandmother, this wonderful bit of magic happens between them. They look at each other intently, and this wonderful smile comes across both their faces, and it's just joyful. Obviously, we haven't really been able to explain to either that who they are to each other, but they know there's this wonderful bond, and they're rejoicing that every time they're with one another, and they smile and they laugh, and Archie will start to babble to my mum, and my mum will answer him. There might be just one word or two, you know, she'll say lovely or beautiful, lovely boy. And there's just this joy that is completely infectious as soon as you go in there. This wonderful connection between great-grandmother and grandson, which all these things, you know, that's not just everyone listening, you all know that fantastic feeling that we all get, that wonderful thing. And I think when you write, it's those kind of moments, things that move you, things that make you feel something, an emotion. They're the things that other people can tap into and recognise and enjoy. So reading The Things You Missed While You're Away, yes, it's about me and it's about my daughter, but it's universal in that there's everything in there that, as a child, you don't have to have been a parent to enjoy those kind of stories, because you've been a kid and you know exactly how those moments felt, what it was like for you. So you get to relive them. But you've all got your own stories. You've all got your own wonderful individual lives, which are rich pickings to start your writing. And even if you want to write in a completely different genre, like a science fiction, you can still... The best science fiction, I think, is based in truth. You know, it comes from real characters, even though they may have superpowers, unearthly powers, and be in a different timescale where technology perhaps has gone on leaps and bounds from where we are. There's still, its roots are still in people and how people react to one another. So please go away, pick up your pens, pick up your laptops, start writing. If you don't fancy that, start reading what somebody else has written. And if you enjoy what you've read, by all means, please feel free to read a review, because that's... write a review. Read reviews, write reviews, because that's the best gift you can give an author. If you've enjoyed their work, is to put it out there. You know, even if you do a post on Facebook or put it up on one of the other sites, anything is gold dust and very, very much appreciated. So, we're nearly all out of time. That has gone super quick. Thank you so much for listening. Please join me next week when I'll be joined by our very own Maggie Curry. Now, Maggie is a lady of very, very many talents, and we're going to unveil each one 1 o'clock next Friday on A Woman's Wit, Wisdom and Pratfall. So please join Maggie and I, where we'll be having a really good chat about so many issues. Like I say, Maggie is a very... talented lady. Yeah, fingers in lots of pies. So I think that's going to be a really... I'm looking forward to that one immensely. And you have a fantastic weekend. Thank you very much for your time. I've been Joan Ellis, and I look forward to talking to you again very, very soon. Bye-bye. Thank you for your time. www.vectusradio.com